The Debrief is a production of faculty at the National Security Affairs Department at the U.S. Naval War College. The views presented here are those of the speakers and do not represent the positions of the Department of Defense or any of its components.
Welcome, everyone, to this edition of the Debrief podcast, a podcast production of the National Security Affairs Department at the U.S. Naval War College. I'm your co-host, Nick Vozdev, a professor in the National Security Affairs Department. And with me today is Lieutenant Colonel Dr. Paul Lushenko of the U.S. Army War College. We will have a fascinating discussion today on a topic that is very much in vogue, of looking at how we can use our technology and our machinery for better impacts in the battle space and beyond. And really, I think people thinking that there's always a technological fix to the problems that we face today. But before we get into our conversation, just a reminder that the conversation we have today is between the two of us in our personal capacity as subject matter experts, and we are not speaking on behalf of the U.S. Navy or the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense or the U.S. government more broadly. So with that, Paul, welcome to the Debrief.
Nick, thank you very much for having me. I look forward to sharing this important conversation with you and the viewership today.
I had sent to you before our conversation today, the latest issue of Time Magazine is a map of Ukraine in a digital type of format. And it's essentially asking the question, are we in the first AI war? Are we in the first machine war? In many ways different. And perhaps, and you know, we do had some precursors with Armenia and Azerbaijan in 2020. But maybe lay out the landscape for us. Where are we with this notion of integrating artificial intelligence, uncrewed systems, big data accumulation, quantum computing, fourth industrial revolution technologies, all the areas of machinery, so to speak, that are being said that will revolutionize the way that we organize and fight?
Yeah, we'll start off with the softball on that one. But it's an important question, right? Because I think some of these capabilities, which we would have to define as fully autonomous capabilities, meaning that they can identify, they can track, and they can engage potentially on their own accord with no human oversight and enemy personnel, target, or whatever, is quite novel and quite scary, right? In my sort of expert capacity, and I teach at the U.S. Army War College as an assistant professor, what I often tell people who are interested in this space is we have to put in context what it is we think we're seeing unfold in Ukraine and elsewhere. And I think three ways that we can do so is in terms of first differentiating between the sort of character versus nature of warfare. So to what extent are these capabilities not just altering the way that we apply force in the context of conflict, but why we do so in the first place? Remember, as you know, and you teach your students here likely, to include my twin brother at one point a couple of years ago, the nature of warfare is politicized. It's designed to achieve a political objective. It's intensely human. It's a clash of wills. That is different from the character which is based upon the use of different capabilities that are emerging. So to the extent to which these capabilities have been revolutionary or game-changing, I think really what we're talking about is the character of warfare. The second thing that I would offer is to take a look at the strategic context of conflict. We often will think about, let's say, a semi-autonomous drone like the MQ-9 Reaper, which is the most advanced drone in the world, manufactured by General Atomics in San Diego, as conducting only counterterrorism, high-value targeting, targeted killings. But the reality is this capability and others like it, to include low-tier capabilities like are being used in Ukraine, or mid-tier capabilities like the TB2 Barakatar manufactured by Turkey, can be used to aid, watch, and kill. So they're applicable to the low end of conflict, humanitarian assistance, disaster relief through intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, up to the high end, which is pursuant to like shaping fires against a near-peer adversary. And so the strategic context matters. And then finally, and I've written about this recently and received some pushback from technological determinists that you alluded to here shortly, was let's take a look at the implications of these technologies at echelon, tactically, operationally and strategically. Tactics is about battles. Operationally is about campaigning, integrating these across time and space to achieve an objective for a political purpose. And ultimately, strategy is about linking ends, ways, and means for overall war outcomes, like war termination. From this angle, which is really the graduate level of military science, we can see these capabilities have been tactically effective, operationally to a degree effective, much less so, however, let's say against the context of Ukraine, and then strategically, they don't really result in war outcomes in and of themselves. Drones, for instance, have not allowed Russia to break the back of Ukraine and allow Ukraine to penetrate through this evolving stalemate in Donbass. And so these three sort of frameworks of understanding the strategic context of conflict, understanding the echelon of which these capabilities are being employed, and then furthermore, trying to differentiate the degree to which we're talking about impacts or character versus nature of war, really bring into focus that what we're seeing here is a tactical revolution, I believe, but much less so operationally and strategically revolutionary.
Well, can I press you a bit on that?
Absolutely.
And ask you to connect from the, you know, the military expertise of the House to the policy side, which is, it does seem that there's a willingness to want to embrace these technologies because you think you save. You don't need as many human beings. You say one human being, where we needed five before, now we can have one or have none, depending on how autonomous you want to go. But I was just reading today, and springing this on you, but this morning, Sean McFate was writing a bit about the problems in Ukraine and that you can't get around the fact that it ultimately comes to human power.
That's
you need human beings. You need enough of them. Are you concerned that there is this, as you put it, the technological determinism that policymakers are going to gravitate towards these, as you say, game changers, where, well, now this means we don't have to worry about casualties because somehow the machines are going to do the fighting for us. And what are the risks that you're seeing as you're studying these technologies?
That's a great question. And so I ended the conversation, Pete, so maybe we can offer it to your viewers by saying that there is no magic bullet in conflict. There's no panacea. These capabilities are tactically effective, but they don't change the fate of nations. And ultimately, what you're trying to do is integrate capabilities and personnel, like Sean was talking about in his piece this morning, to impose multiple dilemmas against an adversary that you can exploit because the enemy's got to make trade-offs one way or another. And that when you can accumulate these effects over time, then you start to achieve the sort of war outcomes that are really consequential strategically. Defeat, capitulation, things of this nature. But I think we have to step back and say, okay, what are the normative claims that we make for the use of these capabilities in the first place, which is really the heart of the matter on your question. And the easiest way to think about this is sort of the legal, moral, ethical implications of these capabilities. So legally, aside from the jus ad bellum considerations of the justice of going to conflict in the first place, there are real implications for jus in bello, which is how we use force in the context of conflict, coming down to proportionality, distinction, and necessity. And notwithstanding a lot of the critique from war ethicists, to include Yanina Dill at Oxford and others, that these capabilities actually impose liability to be harmed on civilians, what we can see from the data, which is biased, I truly admit that, is that there are historically unprecedented levels of protection for civilians. Right. And so in my empirical research, for instance, I'll take a look at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which has the best of breed, again, with some bias, frankly, for data that governs U.S. drone strikes. And on balance, you can see that any U.S. drone strike, which has been reported or benchmarked through a triangulation of different data, will show something like 1 to 7 civilian casualties. Any civilian casualty is strategically, morally, and legally problematic. But by way of conflict in the past, certainly large-scale ground combat operations, which we talk about at our war colleges, this is quite radically different. And so the legal precedent here is that we could use these capabilities surgically to remove an enemy combatant or asset and do so in such a way that better protects civilians. The moral implication here is what Bradley Strauser at the Naval Postgraduate School calls the principle of unnecessary risk. That it's actually an obligation for political and military officials to adopt semi-autonomous and fully autonomous drones to protect their forces. There's a force protection sort of obligation here. Now, flip that on its head, and critics will tell you that these capabilities result in morally problematic killing because it's not just asymmetrical killing, it's radically asymmetrical killing, in which case you're removing an inalienable right for someone to defend themselves and killing him or her in such a way that they can't actually defend themselves in the first place. If we think about the ethics of this swath of technology, the biggest claim for war ethicists is that we have resulted in post-heroic war, riskless war, because there's a respatialization of conflict where there's no reciprocity of risk between combatant X and Y on friendly and enemy sides, right? Now, having said all that, the issue becomes, is there a moral hazard that is pushing political officials and military officials to use these capabilities as a first among other option because of everything I just said? The protection of forces, the buying down risks of civilians, surgically removing a capability or enemy personnel. This actually becomes a lot more challenging in a democratic political regime such as the United States in Western democracies, because we pride ourselves, in fact, it's an important norm that's instantiated within our Constitution, of course, of democratic oversight and political accountability. Yeah. But these capabilities, because they aren't widely discussed, circumvent precisely that. And so when we talk about the political issues at hand, it's the fact that politicians, military leaders can use these capabilities virtually at will without any sort of oversight.
Well, and that touches, I think, on a very important point that, you know, what we've seen over the years is the ability of a president to employ kinetic force while really reducing the risks that might have otherwise constrained him or her. So, you know, I'm just thinking back, you know, 20 plus years ago when you had General Zinni really worried about no-fly zones over Iraq, because every day you had a no-fly zone, you ran the risk of losing a pilot.
That's right.
And that pilot could be captured. And now if you say, well, I have a machine that can do a no-fly zone, are you more likely to say, well, let's do more of this because we don't have that in play? And then, of course, as you said, the ethical questions, which is that if you can reduce the cost, moral, physical, legal, financial, human, from your side to say I can use kinetic force without having to do this, I think that then raises this question of, does it make it more attractive to a policymaker to say we have an option for you that will not require you to have to be on station to come to Dover to receive a casket because...
Well, I think it does, right? And we know that war fatigue is inextricably linked to casualty count. Right now, you can overcome some of this syndrome if you're more successful in combat. In other words, you're achieving your military and political objectives. And Peter Fever at Duke and his colleagues show this to be the case, at least by way of statistics, which are always questionable. But nevertheless, I think you have a great point. So just take a look at what took place in Iraq recently. So this is no longer a declared conflict zone.
No.
So what that means is it's not necessarily recognized, authorized by the United Nations to the extent we think that matters. And ostensibly, there's not a lot of U.S. boots on the ground. I mean, there is, but, you know, officially the numbers are kind of squishy. But yet, the United States conducts via CENTCOM, Central Command, a strike against a Khatib Hezbollah commander who was involved by way of intelligence we could discern, in the attack recently that killed three U.S. soldiers at Tower 22 in Jordan. Yeah. And what was the authorization for that? It was the authorization for the use of military force, which was initially passed in 2001 following the terrorist attacks of 9/11 at the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., which was predicated on the so-called GWAT, Global War on Terror, but has been so elastically applied that now a drone strike anywhere can be linked to the AUMF. And so to your point, there is, I believe, this potential for a moral hazard, the least bad option to use the capability notwithstanding some of the consequences. Another sort of anecdotal piece of evidence here is in my conversations with White House officials, some of which I cite in a recent book that we just published on the legitimacy of drone warfare, they talked about a drone in Yemen or Somalia, for this matter, being the least bad option, right? Because unless or until you'll take the Strabitas approach, which is a full-scale invasion, let's say in Yemen to, you know, pound down the Houthis and their attacks on international shipping in the Red Sea, what other options do you have? Really? So great point about the way that the moral hazard will obfuscate some of the other ethical, moral, and legal considerations that other interested parties and experts talk about an awful lot.
Just wanted to close out our conversation. We're discussing this amidst a nationwide cellular outage, which highlights some of the vulnerabilities, right? So we've talked about, hey, these technologies allow you to safeguard at least your human capital, if not that of the enemies. But there are vulnerabilities as well, that these will depend upon all of your technological pieces falling into play. Is there a risk that we could become so dependent or that, as you said, our tactical strategy now becomes so dependent on using these types of technologies that will introduce a new level of vulnerability that, whether it's disrupting communication nodes, new forms of electronic warfare, so on and so forth, that rather than just simply giving us advantages, we can now be taking on new sets of risks?
That is such a great question that I actually, frankly, hadn't considered before. And it's sort of a different perspective on the perceived merit of innovation. So when you talk about military innovation and change, either in peacetime or in wartime, we're talking about what's that kernel of thought that leads for dramatic change in modernization, doctrine, organizations to have a competitive edge over an adversary. In the space of artificial intelligence, that kernel of thought would be what we call the sensor to shooter timeline. That these capabilities, because of the rapid data analytics based upon machine learning, which is a form of AI, will allow us to identify a threat quicker than an adversary, a near-peer adversary in this case, with parity on military capabilities at least, apply an effect quicker than them to maintain an advantage, right? So this is lethal overmatch. To what degree does buying into that assumption at this point, because it's not proven, put us at a disadvantage? And there are people here at the Naval War College, Kendra Koh, if I'm not bastardizing his name, that have talked about the theory of perverse military innovation, that if you don't get innovation right through tests and experimentation, things of that nature, you could actually confront the challenges you're attempting to stave off in the first place. And so in the context of AI, one of these areas that I'm focusing on in my empirical research right now is trust. And I define trust in a sort of technical way, which is to say an expectation that a capability will be used as advertised towards shared goals, right? This is much different from sort of a social psychological definition of cohesion, an interaction over time that builds vulnerability for trust. And if we use that as a definition, to what degree is our assumption that soldiers will trust AI-enabled technologies for human-machine teaming, which is designed to optimize human performance with the addition or aid of a machine? By the way, this is an assumption that's carried by a lot of warfighting concepts across our services, certainly in the Army and I believe in the Navy. But it's unclear to me if user trust is a foregone conclusion.
Yeah.
And so I might just end there because we're going on to a presentation I'm going to give that talks about user trust. But I think that we could be in a position where, on the one hand, we have automation bias, where we trust a capability so much that can lead to unintended consequences. Or on the other hand, we don't condition our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines enough to operate with trust in a capability that we just eschew it, we don't use it. And so you can actually see your question leads to two countervailing directions, but ultimately the same point that there's a dependency or lack thereof that puts us at a disadvantage relative to our adversaries.
Paul, thank you very much for this conversation. I think both for a general audience, but more importantly, for the students at the war colleges and related institutions that use these conversations. These are precisely the issues that are going to be shaping their careers as they move forward in the national security establishment. And this is an excellent way for them to really begin grappling with what are tough issues in a time when they enter into rapid technological change and growing geopolitical uncertainty. So again, thank you for taking us on a tour of the issues of the day.
Thank you so much, Nick, for having me.